Hey, Joe.
Hi.
So this week we're watching another Star Trek, the original series episode, and it is from series 3. It's Spectre of the Gun. Is there anything you want to tell us about it before we launch into it?
Well, Spectre of the Gun was the first episode of season 3 to go before the cameras.
Ah.
And I think you can tell, because I think there's still a little bit of season 2 magic occurring here. It's before, you know, before all the goodwill's run out in season 3, and we get to when the children shall lead and Spock's brain and all that lot, you know. Yeah. And it's one of four scripts in this season that are written by Lee Cronin, which, remember I said to you before,
yeah,
was the pen name for Gene, probably trying to slip under the radar without Gene Roddenberry noticing him. I'm going to say straight off the bat, I think this is a really strong episode of the original series. And I think it basically gets everything right that Spock's brain got wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I honestly had not seen it all the way through before. And I am fairly certain I've been in the room when it's been on or something. Like, I've seen bits of it. And obviously, it's terribly iconic.
Yeah, it's the imagery, isn't it, that sticks in your head. I deliberately have come today wearing a maroon red t-shirt.
Yeah, it's the exact color of the sky in this episode. Yeah, it's amazingly good. It's very simple. Like, it's super straightforward. It does have something to say, I think.
Do you remember A Fistful of Data's in TNG?
Yeah.
Which is the other big Western episode of Star Trek. This is so much better than A Fistful of Data's. And you may argue this, but I just think that's directed by Patrick Stewart, that one.
Yeah. Right?
When I was back at college, I did a media course and we studied Westerns, which I've always found very, very boring. But I had a renewed appreciation of them when studying the genre. And just all the fundamental basics of a Western are essentially ignored. It's got all the cliches, but none of the wide open vistas, like none of the filming techniques. But actually, they do far more of that here in a studio than they do in A Fistful of Data. So I feel like that Series 5 episode of TNG is listless. And it feels like they've taken a camera to a Western town for a day and just had a bit of a jolly. Whereas this, I feel like they're actually making a Western in this story and they understand the genre.
I think, though, that A Fistful of Data's does have Marina Sirtis in leather pants in it. So it does have that going for it.
Oh, my God. It has her worst line delivery ever. Do you not remember where she's by the barrel and someone comes in and she's like, goes, "Don't even think about it." And she's trying to do this. She's trying to do this American accent. It's really terrible.
But isn't that Deanna doing a bad American accent? Like, isn't that deliberate? I think it's really fun. She's terrific in that episode.
I know we're talking about Spectre of the Gun, but I'm just going to say one thing. Do you not remember where it's like she goes, "What? Durango. My name's Durango." He goes, "Oh, yes. Counselor Durango."
It's so much fun.
There's some fun bits in it. And I love the buxom woman who's like, "Oh, marry me." And it's Brent Spiner playing it with a pair of tits on.
That's right.
It's not fun. I just don't think it's a great Western.
No.
Whereas, you know, this isn't really a Western, is it? It's like First Contact and there's all sorts happening within this episode. But it just gets the sort of the imagery right and the tone.
I think it's really properly tense and I think it's beautifully directed.
Yeah, it is. And you know, we've been talking about action sequences in Berman Trek last week, you know, when they were in that shuttle pod and literally just sort of touching the walls a bit. Whereas there's an action sequence at the end of this. There's a high angles and handheld camera work and it's all very exciting. And I'm like, oh, this was 30 years earlier, for God's sakes, you know?
Yeah. It's not the sort of thing that Star Trek The Next Generation would have attempted at all. I guess we can talk about that as we're going through, but this is the sort of thing that maybe Star Trek The Next Generation might have done it in season 1 before they sort of settled
really,
down.
Really, really terribly.
You know, very badly.
It would have had Tasha Yar being madly over the top, you know. I'll protect you, Captain. You know.
It's so bad.
But what this does as well, you know, is, you know, one of your many complaints of 90s era Trek, I know you love it, is that it isn't quite visually weird enough or conceptually weird enough sometimes. And I think this does that in space. And you said to me before, original Trek kind of scores on that level. And that's where kind of Discovery picks up the mantle, but does it with a massive budget, you know, the same sort of thing.
Yeah, no, it wants to be like original Trek in a way that Star Trek The Next Generation absolutely doesn't want to be.
Although nothing's like original Trek in terms of melodrama, because there's plenty of that in this as well.
So good.
Everyone's taking it so fucking seriously, aren't they? I'm like, are you mad? Have you not seen the absurd things that are occurring around you? And there's Shatner behaving like he's in the gravest Shakespeare play you've ever seen. You know,
he's so good in this.
Yeah, he's very good. And I think this is before, like I said, the first one in series three. So this is before the goodwill of the actors has run out as well. If you recall, Spock's brainwaves writhing about on the floor quite a lot.
Yeah. Do you think we should get going?
Oh, yeah. I can't wait. Let's see the gunfight at the OK Corral.
All right. Well, I will count us in that case. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And we're off.
Did you realise that how long the pre-credit sequence was in this?
Oh, how long was it? It does take a while, doesn't it?
It's nearly 5 minutes. It's the second longest in original Trek.
Wow, okay. Mm. I mean, they routinely do 15 minutes nowadays, don't they?
Yeah, but you said it the other week. They don't play by the rules anymore, do they? You know, they do they do part three of a two-parter 10 years later or whatever.
Yeah, 30 years later. So I think, so when I watched it today, I watched the new special effects. Did you? Can you see the new special effects?
So
now?
I'm watching on Netflix and they've only got the new special effects and it's all like in beautiful HD. So this sort of direction just felt even more crisp, you know?
It looked really good. I think I am now watching for the first time the original special effects. So. Okay. Yeah. So last time I watched it on Netflix as well, and so I got the very, very crisp and beautiful, you know, that opening shot over the Enterprise and stuff that starts the episode, and that this sort of weird.
What are you seeing on the screen right now, then?
So it is a rotating boy. It is rotating and changing color, but it's just a physical object, I think.
Oh, okay.
That's being lit.
I mean, I'll never condemn original Trek for having ropey special effects. It was groundbreaking at the time.
Yeah. And we spoke about this, didn't we? I think that the new special effects are a way of ensuring that the show continues to have an audience and that it looks as good as it possibly can. And they're pretty sympathetic.
The trouble with it is I think with episodes like this, which I don't really think there's anything too embarrassing about this episode. So it just enhances how good it all looks. Mm. Whereas if it's a really shit episode, it just enhances how crap it is, doesn't it? You know?
So once again,
even
we get the
in HD glory, you know?
It blinks in the special edition.
No, does it?
Yep.
it's inanimate, but it blinks. You know?
Yeah. It blinks. I love this thing too, where they all hear it in their own language, Swahili and Vulcan, and it's that same voice that, not quite the same voice, but the same kind of voice as we got in the episode we did last time. I'm completely blanking on the
Spock's brain.
Not Spock's brain. No, the one before that. Oh, the Corbomite maneuver.
Oh, you know, yeah. It's always an Englishman, isn't it? Playing the mysterious voice. I could do it.
I think it's like a very, very serious American radio presenter or something. It's that sort of this voice is slightly different, but it's the same sort of thing. I mean, this is very Corbomite maneuver at the beginning, isn't it? A mysterious object, you know, giving ultimatums to them and stuff.
But it did highlight, you know, you said about the Swahili thing. It did highlight just how little Uhura is in this. And actually, it would have been so nice if she'd have gone down to the... Because, like, if this had been, like, a DS9 episode, you'd have had Dax and you'd have Kira down there, you know, gunslinging and being very cool. In Fistful of Data, you had Marina Sirtis in the hat, you know, the mysterious stranger come into town. Whereas this is all men, this episode.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a shame.
The Western is that, though, isn't it? I mean...
But this is supposed to be progressive, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is progressive, and that's one of the things that it actually says, but perhaps just not progressive enough.
I think the only woman in this, isn't it, is the one who's fixated on Chekhov.
Yeah, that's properly funny too. You said they take it seriously, but the Chekhov relationship with that woman is actually pretty funny.
That is funny, but no, I mean Shatner, he's taking it very seriously.
Yeah.
This, you know, but look, in a very, I mean, it makes it funnier, I think, how serious he takes it. Now, this is so weird, them stepping through the smoke and then the mysterious face that comes out of the fog.
It's really good too. I mean, it's clearly sort of papier-mâché or something. Like, it's not...
But they haven't changed that. They haven't changed that, I don't think.
No.
Because it's good enough, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Can I just say, James Doohan was appalled at Scotty's new backcomb look. Now, I know we mentioned this in Spock's brain. He's got the Brill Cream going. And unfortunately, he did get his own way eventually and his hair went back to normal. But because they did the episodes out of order... He's back combing. He's normal. Jesus. He's back combing. Scotty can't make up his mind, you know.
He's experimenting with a new look this year.
But I think this is really quite chilling looking, this face. It's kind of like your head can't get around it, you know. It's a bit weird.
Yeah. Look, I mean, it's kind of crap and it's saved by some strategic lighting and a lot of smoke. And it has a sort of skull-like look to it too, I think. But it's that thing where you're, you know, we talked about on Discovery, sometimes you're just not quite sure what it is that you're seeing.
Yeah.
And I think that's that.
Are you kidding
me?
This whole episode's like that. I said to you before we started recording, my brain just kept switching off. I'd not been able to process what I was in these flats in a Western town and,
you know,
bizarre things occurring. But I don't know. Like, we've seen, you know, in an original Trek, we're massive fans of Doctor Who. We've seen far worse. And that alien,
For sure. Yeah.
And also, like, you know, you remember the episode with Abraham Lincoln flying through space and takes him down to the planet, and there's that massive turd creature that comes glowing eyes and smoke all coming off him. Amazing, you know. Mm. I still think they could pull it out of the bag, you know, in series three.
Yeah. And they're willing to go weird. I mean, this is very, very weird, this episode. And kind of incomprehensible. Like, it doesn't make sense. And it sort of plays by weird rules.
Well, I don't know. I think, I mean, it doesn't make sense as in they put them through this very strange ordeal in order to get to the point. But the point makes sense is, like, are you violent?
Yeah.
If you are, we do not want to know you. If you're not, come to our planet, you know?
Yeah.
It's just a very surreal way of figuring that out, you know?
Yeah.
Go on.
No, I'm just kind of thinking, right, this is what, 1968, I think. And there are a lot of Westerns on television in America in 1968. And Star Trek, you know, that wagon train to the stars thing, it is a sort of space Western where you turn up somewhere and you fix something and then you disappear. Yeah. You know, it has some of that structure. It's got a lot of Western in its DNA.
The actual premise of DS9 was that it was a frontier town. Mm. Like, you've got the sheriff and you've got the bar, you know. So DS9 was, and all the strangers come to town with their stories. And, but, you know, that was basically the idea of it. I think Next Gen pushed away from that a little bit, but original series was definitely, what was it called? Wagon
Train to the Stars. Yeah. And so this is Star Trek saying, we're not this. We're not a Western and we don't approach the problem solving thing the way that a Western does.
Yeah.
Because a Western solves problems through violence.
Aren't we? Mm. We are an enlightened human species. But yeah. I do love, I'm preempting now, I do love the bit where Kirk says, actually, I wanted to be violent. I wasn't, but I wanted to be. So it's like, you know, the potential is still there. I just want to point out how spectacularly good the lighting is in this episode. And I think the reason why it's so visually impressive is because of how the characters are highlighted. There's almost something very theatrical about it. It's like they're on a stage and there's a lot of kind of shadows behind them. They're sharply contrasted against it. Lighting in 60s television is vital.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Like some of our favorite 60s shows that aren't Star Trek and things shot in black and white, where again, lighting absolutely makes it. But look, there's shadows on their faces, like, and there's lots of black in the frame. It's really interesting. It is the sort of thing that you might have got in lighting in black and white.
You know, in sharp contrast to Spock's brain that we watched, remember we were going, well, like, it's so linear and there's just nothing happening and they're just going from A to B to C and there's just no substance to it. There's a mystery here to solve, you know, in a very weird setting. So I'll just say, and it is a proper, this is like what I imagine original Star Trek to be. It's a proper adventure with these fun group of characters, you know?
Yeah.
This just feels like distilled TOS to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, when the sky is realized through flats, which happens so often in original Trek and in early Next Gen as well.
Oh, boy, does it. Yeah.
Yeah. It never looks good. And imagine if they had decided that they were going to go for a more realistic kind of take on it and it had been a blue flat, you know, and they had shot around the fact that the buildings aren't all built or whatever, it would have been so lackluster, like so much less interesting.
It's so bizarre, isn't it? It's so bizarre that the budget actually leans into this, like the lack of budget, sorry, leans into this being more impressive than it otherwise would have been because they've got these weird flats, which are clearly flat, you know, like there's no depth to them at all, and it's a hard setting to process. And when they were going into rooms
that don't have walls,
and they were still outside, but it was all set up like a bar or a sheriff's office and things like that.
Yeah,
my brain just kept saying, "What is going on?"
The red is really, really oppressive, and it's blood red, isn't it, for an episode about violence?
Do you think that's deliberate?
Well, I don't know. Possibly. It only just occurs to me, but it's an unpleasant red. I mean, look at the red of Scotty's uniform, which is just a much more kind of standard, it's, you know, primary color red. But this is like, it's like a bruise or something. It's unpleasant. And it's really, really iconic. Yeah. But like, are there walls in there, but they're just painted the same red? No.
No, there's no walls. It's literally, there's no walls. It's not a set. It's just the exterior flat, and then you go in, and it's like a set.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Obviously, this was originally, I said to you before we put it, this was supposed to be done on location. And I don't think it would be anywhere near as impressive if it had been.
No, I think it would have been a bit terrible.
Or it would have been memorable. Yeah.
Yeah, it would have been Star Trek does its Western episode. Like A Fistful of Datas, where are they on the Paramount lot or something? It's just they've got a Western town lying around they can shoot in.
They do go out on location, but it does. Yeah. It feels like when Red Dwarf went to a Western town that's in England, right?
And
unfortunately, you know, it's been raining, of course. And so it's all the mud churned up and it basically looks like a Western town plopped in the middle of England. But they shoot it better. Like they shoot it better than The Fistful of Datas. They shoot it more imaginatively. I think the director does make a massive impact on this one.
Yeah, you're right. There's trees.
DeForest Kelly, you know, had been acting in Westerns his entire life, his entire professional career. And he actually played one of the Clannans in a Western.
Oh, did he?
Years earlier. Yeah.
Yeah, this guy is so... That's the other thing. They're really strange looking. Like the men in this town are ugly in all sorts of ways. Like they've got a really hideous bunch of actors of guest cast.
But they're all playing it straight as well. I quite like that, you know. It could have all been very kind of tongue-in-cheek. You remember A Piece of the Action, the Chicago episode?
Yeah.
Now, actually, that belies what we just said there, because that was all done on location. And that, it is fantastic, that episode. It is really, really fun. Look, here we go. Oh, you know Chekhov, right? Apparently, there was a series of memos that did the rounds after series two was over, saying, well, we need to give Chekhov more to do. Hence the fact that he's, in the first episode, he's given this subplot, romantic subplot.
Yeah. Yes, and he gets to do lots of kissing. It's so great.
But I know you'll never go about his beautiful haircut again. I still love it.
It's so dreadful. It's so bad.
He always looks a bit baffled, doesn't he? He's very Rob-like.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's this thing straight away. Kirk doesn't try to solve the problem through violence. He refuses to draw, even before he kind of quite knows what's going on. Like, it's not clear that this is a test, is it? The Malkoshians have said to them that they are going to be killed, that they're being killed here. And so they're expecting, you know, and they've been put here to be killed in this sort of way. And like, I don't know that the script makes it very clear, but it seems clear that they have, well, the script says they've read Kirk's mind and that that's where they got the town from.
Do you think he watches a lot of Westerns then, Kirk?
But they don't talk about it in those terms. Like, if you did it now or with A Fistful of Daters, it's a Western rather than a frontier town, whereas this is America in 1881 and it's super violent and that's how problems are solved around here. And it's made clear that the law doesn't mean anything and it is just the person who wins at the gunfight who wins.
So I suppose it does make sense in a weird sort of way, in that they are manipulated into a situation where the cliche dictates that violence is the solution.
Yeah. Yeah.
But because they're never told it's a test, it's like, you know, yeah.
I just love everyone else's reaction because Chekhov gets to kiss someone and they're all just kind of sitting there being slightly annoyed.
I love the fact that Spock's got a gun around his belt.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
He's great in this as well. I thought Leonard Nimoy was really good in this.
Oh, there's an electric scene a little bit later, like in the episode, which I just think he's magnificent in. So good.
Can I ask you a question? Do you think they pull this off with more aplomb than the other 60s studio-bound Western that we both know about, which is Doctor Who's The Gunfighters?
Yeah, see, it's interesting, isn't it, that Doctor Who did this, like did a Western in a studio, and it's also about the gunfight at the OK Corral. Like, it seems to be, you know, the thing that we're doing, it must be in the air.
Well, it's kind of like the most exciting thing you can do with it, isn't it? It's like you're building up to a climax with a massive shootout, you know?
Yeah, and Doctor Who does that. It's largely comedic. I think it lags a bit. We all, because for a long time everyone hated the gunfighters because they hadn't seen it. And then when we all saw it, we discovered that it was actually really quite fun.
But, like, it's superbly executed. I think it's really well directed.
Yeah.
And, in fact, I would say it's doing something quite different from this, obviously, because this is deliberately fucking old. That's just going for it is a Western. But, like, the finale of The Gunfighters is all shot on film, like Star Trek is. And it's all that gunfight is genuinely dynamic. It's really, really good. So I don't know. It's interesting that on, you know, probably 1/10 of the budget, they can achieve the same sort of effects.
Yeah. Whereas Star Trek, like, like I want to say this is budgetary reasons, and it must be. You were saying earlier, Joe, that the original intention had been to shoot this on location or on the back lot or something where they're actually outside and we've got the real sky and everything. And then they decide they can't afford to do that. But they could still have attempted to do what Doctor Who did, which was to try and look realistic.
Yeah.
But they don't. Like, it. It's so funny. Where this guy says to who he thinks is Ike Clanton that he can't show his ugly face around here again, or he was told not to show his ugly face around here again. And the two of them are so fucking ugly. And they're talking about Shatner. Look how rough these people look.
Shatner looks very pretty, though.
He does. Yeah. He's not the one with the ugly face in this scene.
No. You're being so mean about these poor cowboys.
But don't you think that's deliberate? Like, I think the way that they are scary looking and impassive, and the director actually puts them in these sort of tableaus as well. Like, there's frequently a few of them in shot at the same time, and you know their faces are half in shadow, and I think they seem really quite frightening.
I think as well that because Shatner pitches his performance very seriously, it does actually feel like there's a genuine threat here.
Yeah,
because if they were all going around like, oh well, this is fun, oh, it's jolly on a western, you know, flat, how delightful, I don't think, you know, we'd be as invested as we are.
We think if Tom Paris was here talking about westerns and how much he loves them or something.
Oh my God, Tom, you know, you're the biggest fan of westerns, aren't you? Yeah, they've never been mentioned before. You know, on the shelf next to your book of trucks and your book of cartoons and,
Yeah, exactly. Crappy 50s sci-fi, the whole thing. In fact, the one person who doesn't take it seriously is Chekhov.
He doesn't take anything seriously, though.
No, but he gets to... This stuff is so funny. So this is the alcohol, the... And McCoy's giving it to them because it's medicinal. Mm-hmm. They ought to label it for external use only. It's such a great line.
McCoy kind of slouched on the table there. Like, he's loving
he? He's absolutely at home in this Western, I think.
They do have fantastic chemistry, though, don't they? And I know I'm complaining that it's all blokes, but as an ensemble, like, it's rarely been bettered, I think.
Yeah.
It is weird, though, because I find it in the later seasons, that's where I don't remember Scotty being around that much in Series 1. And so obviously Chekhov when he came in Series 2. So they were trying to broaden things a bit in later years, you know?
But I still think it's those three, the three main ones, who are so good together. Where Chekhov says if he gets shot at by this gun because it's not a phaser, he can just walk out of the way. Like, he's not frightened by this.
Dude, do you think they're setting up something that might happen later on in the episode?
Well, I think they are.
Do you know that sky is looking even more oppressive now? I swear it's getting darker.
Yeah. It's really good, isn't it? Such a good choice.
And, you know, like we said about being on location, if that was the case, then we wouldn't have had any of the oppressive lighting that we've talked about either. It would be such a different episode.
They have less control over it. Yeah.
And it's so wonderful because it looks cheap, but it's deliberate. Like, you know? Like,
yeah.
Although if you turned on now and went, oh, well, what is this? You know? Like, but it's doing that wonderful thing that Star Trek at its best does, and that's taking something familiar and something weird. And I think TOS does that extremely well. You know, we'll go down to a quarry. Oh, look, there's the bunny out of Alice in Wonderland running around.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Like, well, what about this clock, which just seems to be hanging in the sky? So when we see the shots of the clock that's counting down to 5 p.m., it's not hanging on anything.
Yeah.
It's just in the sky. And I think that's so great.
I like the bizarre dramatic zooms in and out when we go from scene to scene, you know?
Yeah, that's very strange.
You'd be all over that. You love all that sort of stuff in Discovery.
Yeah. Roll the camera over.
It's not a stationary camera watching Seven of Nine walk away stately. Did you watch all of this at the time? TOS?
No. So the last episode of TOS is the only one that was broadcast in my lifetime.
Oh my God, I made you sound really old.
How old do you think I am?
Oh my God.
I'm looking a bit rough this evening. That might explain it.
I'm sorry. That question came out wrong. Please allow me to rephrase that. I do not think you're like 70 years old, all right? He's very pretty, everybody, honestly. sorry, did you watch this when you were a child is what I meant?
No, I didn't. And I remember as a kid being told that Star Trek was scary and would give me nightmares. And I did see little bits and pieces of it. But the first Star Trek that I ever seriously watched was Star Trek The Next Generation. And then after that, I went back and looked at some of these.
But there's still gaps, isn't there? You haven't watched all of TOS.
Look at this. That sign that says teeth pulling by appointment is hanging in the air.
Well, I mean, I think I can just about see a string, but yeah, I get the idea.
But yes, isn't that such a great choice? It's such an odd thing to do.
And I think this is great as well. You've got Doc Holliday in the chair, right? And McCoy's coming in to steal his supplies. And it's a weird thing about McCoy just going, well, I need it, so I'm going to have it, you know?
Yeah.
And he gets up. He's really menacing. The performance is really menacing.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? It's kind of like, well, we're prepared to let you do this. We don't care because we're going to shoot you dead in a couple of hours.
I will say, though, good grief, I've forgotten the guy's name. Scott McNulty from Random Trek, of which we are still waiting on an invite to appear on that.
Where's our invite, Scott?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't brought that certainly out for a while. But he always says that TOS episodes are about 5 or 10 minutes too long.
Yeah.
And I generally think it's true. And this didn't sag as badly as some, like Spock's brain, for example. but this could be a little snipped, I think.
But I'm the one who complains about how slow 90s Trek is. And I think this is slow, but the kind of slowness of it, you know, everyone's moving slowly. It's like they're really playing into creating tension. I think there's a lot of shots of just these guest characters standing around looking menacing. And I think that works.
Did you notice the music in this episode? Like the fun Western themes. Now, this was Jerry Fielding that did music for this. And he only did one other Star Trek episode. And that was The Trouble with Tribbles. And that's got a really distinctive musical score.
Yeah.
They should have had him back more often, I think.
Yeah, he's good then. I think this was good.
Oh, here she is.
Yeah, see.
I really want a tough woman in this. Actually, maybe we should have been first season TNG. We could have had Tasha Yar, couldn't we?
Yeah, so this is a big scene though, isn't it?
Oh, Chekhov gets his robots. Do you know what though? He's such a bloody lech. Every planet he goes on, he's trying to cop off for somebody. Seriously, even in the dark recesses of Kirk's mind here, he's still trying to get off for somebody. Well, that's the idea, isn't it? Isn't this all in Kirk's head?
No, I don't think so.
Is this actually on the planet? They say in the last scene, don't they? None of it happens.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure about that. Like, they say that Chekhov was up on the bridge the whole time.
Because you know what this feels like, don't you? This does feel like a holodeck episode.
Yeah, well, you see, I think that the holodeck exists to give a more serious, sensible explanation for why we're going to have a story set in, you know, why we have a piece of the action, or what's that one where they, it's ancient Rome, you
oh,
know.
God. Is that Requiem for Methuselah? Oh, it's really, really terrible. Or the one, or the one with Rome where it's a TV studio. Like, it's literally being filmed and it's all part of like the political agenda of the planet, the gladiatorial games.
Yeah, the bread and circuses.
That one.
Yeah, yeah. And so what they do is they say, well, we can have Westerns or whatever. We've got the holodeck, and so we've got a reason to do it. And
but look what happens. You get Fairhaven and things like that. You know, it goes to such an extreme.
I mean, like, Deep Space Nine definitely does it. I mean, Deep Space Nine does use the holodeck to explore different genres.
I know, but come on. Armand Bashir, bada bing, bada bang.
No, like, they're great.
It does it well. That's the difference.
Yeah, I agree. Unlike Fairhaven.
I'm sure there's a terrible DS9 holodeck episode. I just can't think of any. Like, look at it's like, it even uses the holodeck in like It's Only a Paper Moon, doesn't it, to explore PTSD and things like that.
Mm. Yeah. Well, they do what Voyager does, which is they have a holodeck program that's running all the time, and they go there and visit, and it's their bar, you know.
It's so boring in a way. TOS is just like, oh, well, we're just going to have weird stuff happening.
Yeah,
and it's just happening, you know. We don't need some boring technology to give an excuse.
Well, it's amazing how real the dialogue and the actors make this environment when it's so patently fake, where it's so absolutely leaning into the artifice of being a studio set.
That shot there of the man against the red sky and the two coming behind, that is terrifically directed.
Mm, he's good, this guy. There,
so it just goes to show them within the Fred, what's his name, Freiberger series three, with the reduced budget, if they'd had the imagination and the creativity, we didn't have to have a Spock's brain every other week.
No.
It could have been a Spectre of the Gun, you know.
Yeah.
But then let's be honest, you know, very quickly talking about Doctor Who again, like they did that all the time. No money, lots of imagination. No,
that's right.
I think it was the fact that the goodwill of the network was gone. And I don't think there was anybody casting a decent eye over the writing.
Look at that shot that we went to the ad break on, where they're all tiny in the distance, all sort of huddled up, and there's like the dark figures of the men much, much bigger in the front of the frame. It's so well done. And the three shot of them just looking completely impassive with their moustaches.
Does this raise the stakes? So do we think Chekhov is dead?
No, I don't think we do. And I was wondering what effect that has. Was it a good idea or not? Because I don't think we think that Chekhov is dead. And
I'm assuming at the time Chekhov like landed well with the audience, because they wouldn't be saying, well, we need to give him more to do, if they were getting bad feedback about, you know,
but I mean, Walter Koenig. They're not going to do a Skin of Evil and kill one of the regulars early on in an episode. That's just not going to happen. And so that means that we know. I mean, we know that they're going to be okay. Like, the tension isn't, are they all going to be killed on this planet or not? Is it?
You remember that episode where McCoy gets a life sentence at the that he's going to die. He's going to die imminently of this disease. And he's like, oh, Jim, you know, I only got a week to live. And then, you know, and the whole episode is about his mortality. And at the end, it's like, oh, there's the cure. Oh, thanks. That's it. I don't think mortality is much of a thing, is it? I mean, you can take someone's brain out of their head and they still survive.
Yeah, they're better next week. They're fine by the end of the episode. So I think that this scene is terrifically good, and it's McCoy being super racist about...
Oh, I find this a bit troubling, you know.
Well, no, I mean, but it's the thing with, they forget I'm half human, and then Troy is abashed and realizes what an asshole he's been, because... Even though Spock doesn't, and you can see, it's so subtle from Nimoy's performance, but you can see that he's feeling it, even despite that impassivity that he has. I think he's really good.
I've said to you before, I really like the chemistry between DeForest Kelly and Leonard Nimoy, and I think it's one of the best Star Trek pairings, and it's, you know, why in all the other shows they say Tuvok and Neelix, it's this show's Bones and Spock, you know.
Yeah, and they've never successfully replicated it, have they?
Oh, Odo and Quark, I think that works brilliantly. It's quite different, yeah. But it's a contentious relationship that you buy into and love.
Yeah, but I mean, here, that central, we talked about this before, the central three where you've got someone for whom emotion is important and someone who is trying to work without emotion or work around their emotions, and then you've got a guiding principle that has to adjudicate between them.
I think what's different, isn't it, here is the relationship is given such prominence because they are two of the three main characters in this, whereas in all the other shows, it's an ensemble piece.
They're ensembles, yeah.
Yeah, they come together every now and again, whereas they, you know, there's a Bones and Spock scene in pretty much every episode.
Yeah.
They are racist to varying degrees.
Yeah, that's right.
Sometimes it really bothers me, though. It really, and I'm just like, and yeah, I know it's a product of the time, and you know, I'm not going to go down that route, but it wouldn't happen now. Yeah, you wouldn't have those scenes now.
No. Yeah, we wouldn't be expected to retain sympathy for McCoy, for a character who behaved like McCoy or spoke like McCoy.
Even a, one of the sort aliens. Of a, an outwardly villainous character like Georgiou in Discovery, she doesn't really say racist things, does she? She's,
well, she did eat that Kelpian.
Well, that's just very good taste, isn't it? Nice bechamel sauce. Delightful.
Yeah, now here's another one of these ugly guest stars, and good God, the sheriff is rough looking, isn't he?
Ooh, he's up against William Shatner, who's looking very pretty. So you go, I like that. They've got the wind machine going. They're actually blowing leaves from the studio as well.
I
do think it is good, though, that they play Chekhov's death for real.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm convinced they think he's real, even though we kind of know, well, this is a weird episode, so he's going to pop out of nowhere at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, look at this guy. It's so good because this is the clearest explanation of how problems are solved in the world here. You know, that you've got the sheriff saying, you should shoot these people dead because we're sick of them, and everyone would think that was okay, and I wouldn't stand in your way.
Is there anything more delightful than seeing William Shatner downcast, bunching his fists, looking like he's going to cry and getting all emotional? It's just wonderful. I mean, I can't hear him, but it just looks fabulous.
Yeah.
I mean, it does go to an extreme, because in the one with the children, when the children shall lead, Kirk thinks he's going mad, and all of a sudden he's in like the turbo lift and he's like smashing walls and going, I'm losing my mind, you know, like, and it's all a bit much. But the smoke bomb. Have I missed the bit where Scotty inhales the entire smoke? I mean, I think just being that close to all that smoke would knock you out a little bit.
No, because it's not real. The laws of chemistry don't apply. And it's funny because the world is so artificial and they take it so seriously that they're actually shocked by the fact that these chemicals that they've mixed up don't behave right. You know, the laws of physics and chemistry don't apply in this world, so it's a strange place.
It's essentially like the TV equivalent of a stage play, isn't it?
Yeah.
And like, you know, the audience in a theatre, if the actors are compelling enough, you literally forget you're in a theatre and you're just in the story. Oh, I don't know what Scotty's saying right now, but he looks very pleased for himself. I do like the fact that they are trying to use the conventions of the genre to find the solution. He goes, doesn't he? Well, what have we got here that we can use that prevents us from being violent, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And that's like all the way through, that's they want to negotiate, they don't want to fight. Like there's never a moment until the end, you know, where we see them tempted to do the gunfight.
That looks like the warp core breach drink that Quark serves. All that smoke coming
dry
out.
Dry ice.
Yeah. Poor Scotty.
Oh, look at that.
He's like the Sergeant Benton. He's like, yeah, I don't mind. I'll just I'll inhale all the smoke. Bless him.
He's really getting into it too. Yeah. It's so ridiculous. Yeah, it's not working. Like, yeah.
He's going, no dizziness, no sweaty, no palpitations. Like, yeah. I'm clearly fine, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So we are reaching the point then where they are coming to the inescapable conclusion that they may have to use violence.
That they have to fight. Yeah. Yeah, that they have to fight the clans. They just have to. I mean, the Earps, I get them all mixed up.
And it is interesting because, like, Shatner plays it like that is a genuine conflict. Like he is he's better than that, but he's got to do it. You know, that's quite an ask of an actor. Oh, that whopping great close-up on that clock. Hanks.
It's suspended so in the good. Air. It's so great.
Look at the picture as well. You zoom. See the picture behind them?
Yeah, the picture's just hanging in the air as well. And the it's light. Amazing. Yeah.
Oh, here we go. Zoom, new location.
Yeah.
And this sequence now in the OK Corral, I thought this was really well directed. And they're throwing everything at it now. Look, the sky is practically black. The wind machine's going. There's leaves everywhere.
Yep. Oh, Shatner's hair's all over the place.
And, you know, I'm going to tell you something that's going to stun you rigid. The camera moves.
I love it when that happens.
Oh, so hang on.
Oh, lightning.
Is it down on all of them, or does Kirk have to be the one who, you know, chooses to fight or not?
Yeah, I don't know. Because they get it from Kirk's mind, don't they? So they clearly have decided that we are a violent race because this is his background. Like they say, it's his cultural background. I mean, it's McCoy's as well, isn't it? But or is McCoy from Canada? I don't know.
I don't think there's any, we're under any illusion that Kirk doesn't think he's the lead in his own story. So yeah, they're like, okay, well, it's clearly him then. He's the one that's got a fight.
And it's, this...
go on, sorry.
Well, I think this solution is really strange. And I kind of like it. And what's the solution? How do they not get involved in the fight? They deny the reality of the fight. I don't know if that's really practical in a, you know, in the real world or whatever, but...
So you know what this is then, don't you? This is like the precursor to Move Along Home. They were never in any real danger all along.
No, it turns out.
And in fact, you know, TOS is exactly the sort of show where they'd be standing around going, ha, 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 you know, like, we all thought we were going to die and use violence, you know. Oh, dear. There's a lot of episodes that end like that, you know.
Yeah.
And the music goes, do, 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 do you know what? I think doing this with you, right, I'm getting far more of a love for the original series than I ever had before.
Yeah, I think, like, even the bad one that we did was sort of fun. Oh, like, you know, there
that was
fun
so
to be
bad,
had.
It circled around and was magnificent.
No, I don't agree with that. I think it was just very bad, but it was enjoyable to watch.
Brain is brain. What is brain?
What is brain?
But no, I just... It's really interesting jumping about the entirety of Star Trek. And I figured it would be. But I don't think I've ever done this. I did it for my review website, but I don't think I've ever done this and discussed it like this.
Yeah.
It really highlights the strengths and the weaknesses of each era. And TOS is one of TOS's massive strengths is it's just its fucking ability to just go for it. You know? Which 90s Trek doesn't as much.
No. I think, too, it benefits from getting the opportunity to do things for the first time. And, you know, this whole environment was a throwaway gag in Lower Decks. And Lower Decks, one of the jokes that happens in Lower Decks all the time is, you know, crew members are always brought back from the dead and here's eight possible reasons or this is the reason why Boimler has a girlfriend and here's 15 possible reasons from previous episodes.
Yeah.
And so this sort of disbelieving and illusory environment where that happens just all the time. It happened in the episode of Picard that aired most recently, where Seven has to work out whether she's in a real environment or not. And so we've seen it over and over and over again, but not by this point. And so they can properly kind of just let the concept breathe because it so hasn't
maybe
been
maybe the extra time is a good thing, you know, for that.
Yeah.
I just want to point out, because I don't think I'm going to say this too often in the original Trek, just how spectacularly directed all this is. You've got a tight shot here on McCoy and Spock, spotlit from above. Very dramatic. You've got the villains coming through. There's lightning striking their faces. All of the backdrop is being lit up, and it's like something out of a horror movie. It's all
really carefully choreographed too. Yeah. That shot is there so that they're all visible in it as they walk abreast. You said something
when we were having our wonderful discussion about the Bomar last week in the Raven. You said that'll do. There's no that'll do in Spectre of the Gun. It's like, you know what? We ain't got much money. We're gonna make this look as good as we can, you know? And that's a good director. I need to find out who that was.
Yeah, see what else they did.
And, you know, like a story that promises an exciting climax needs to deliver it. And this does, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing's a countdown, isn't it, to 5 p.m. We know that they're going to be killed later on. I think that this would have given me nightmares as a child. I think the people who told me that watching original series would give you nightmares, that was all there was back then.
I mean, that alien looks like a big green penis with glowing eyes. I think my life may have turned out quite differently if I'd have watched this as a child.
And that, like, that's properly scary. Again, with the bit of wood that's behind them getting all the bullet holes in it while they're standing in front of it. It's such a well-staged shot. You know, more shots of the, you know, four characters on each side.
But staggered in a line. Positioned, you know?
It's really thoughtfully done.
Look at Kirk. No one fights like Kirk, I'm telling you. He's standing there like a wrestler, you know? God, he's probably punching him like a nutter.
The bit at the beginning where he just leaps up and kicks him in the chest is pretty great.
Picard would never have done that, would he?
No.
Maybe Riker. No. Riker might have done that. I think he's supposed to be like the Kirkish action man, isn't
he? Yeah, oh yeah, that was the idea. And certainly Philippa Giorgio would obviously kick people in the chest.
There wasn't as much violence there as I remember. No. But I think what makes it so dramatic is all the lead up to it, you know?
Yeah. It's quite short, and it does center on that decision where he just puts the weapon down.
Yeah. You know what? They kind of missed a trick, though, because like, they zoomed in on the OK Corral and out on the medical device that McCoy has. Like, they could have done something like the same shaped object in both. Yeah, that would have been quite a nice transition. But, oh, here we go. She was so beautiful, but she wasn't real. Sorry, Chekhov. You're at home again in bed tonight, I'm afraid. Sorry.
Yeah. Like Geordi.
Oh, look, there's Uhura. I mean, Michelle Nichols must have been like, what is this? I'm in the first and the last scene, and that's it. She wanted to leave, didn't she? I remember reading that. She wanted to leave.
Yeah.
She was convinced by
Martin Luther King.
Yeah, to say, no, you know, you are in a prominent role in a TV show set in the future. Like, whatever they make you do, do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
What is that device that they look through? It looks like, you know, like those old things you used to have as a child.
Viewmaster.
Yeah, and it kind of like, you know, the new picture comes in and you feel like you're in Venice or something like that.
Space. Yeah.
You're someone But it's quite a nice ending with, you know, Kirk having made first contact now with Malkoshians.
Malkoshians.
Better than the fucking Bomar, isn't it? At least there ain't that bloody apostrophe in it. Yeah. Oh, wait. You and me said we were going to measure everybody by the Bomar now.
These are
way better.
Much, much better.
Yeah.
Even though it's just a papier-mâché head, you know, projected against a star field, I think it looks really good.
I will celebrate the day we find the aliens worse than the Bomar, though.
Yeah, I don't think it'll ever happen. But this sort of alien, which Star Trek, like, has all the time, original Trek has all the time, you know, we never get that. We just get various Americans with latex glued to their face. Yeah. And do you remember the Shellyak corporate? I think I mentioned them last week.
What the hell was that?
So it was like, it looked like a big black shape. They were intransigent aliens. We weren't allowed through their space in a very early Star Trek The Next Generation episode. And it was like a black figure in a black room with weird lighting and stuff. And that was a very sort of proper original series alien of a kind that then gets abandoned, I think.
I love, do you remember Nigellum? From that second season episode, where it's this weird sort of baby-looking alien and it's an extreme close-up. Yeah, that's very TOS, that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And before Berman came in and went, this is all a bit embarrassing.
That's too crap.
The music's too dynamic. Can we just make this a bit beige, please?
But so this conversation at the end, where it's the conversation about wanting to kill, that Kirk did want to kill, but he also didn't.
He's saying that line and looking at the audience. We overcame our violence. We're better than this. It's like an episode of Sabrina the Teenage Witch.
But that's good. I think that's good. This is not a Western. Even though it has all sorts of features in common with Westerns as a show, this is a show where they solve problems not just by shooting at things, but by understanding them or rejecting violence or finding a better way. And I think that's awesome.
Well, like we had, okay, so we've done three episodes of Star Trek's on the bounce now. In All Good Things, we had the philosophical moment between Q and Picard in Primordial Earth, which didn't make any sense to us at all. We just felt like they were trying to give it more depth when it wasn't really there. We had the moment between Janeway and Seven at the beginning, where they're talking about the imagination, creativity and all of that. And here we have, you know, discussion on the pros and cons of violence and whether we're better than that in the future. So which show's doing it better for you at the moment?
Well, I think that this episode is very basic and it is a very, very simple message of non-violence, but it's a message that's being broadcast into a world that needs to hear it, I think.
But this embraces the concept. Mm. Doesn't it? It builds the episode around the concept, where the others, it's just, you know, an anomaly and Seven's backstory with a bit of philosophy thrown in. What I do like is that Spock gives him a look when he says, you know, we're all a bit better than this in the future. And Spock's got a very unconvinced look on his face and walks away in silence, saying, oh, I don't think you are, you know. I thought that was quite a nice note to end it on.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I thought that was fantastic.
It's very, very enjoyable. And I think it's worth remembering that even in Star Trek's darkest days, and we've done a couple of season 7 TNGs recently, I'm sure we're going to get around to a season 1 DS9 at some point. And, you know, we've dipped into early Enterprise. Mm. There's still things of merit.
Yeah, oh, for sure. All right, it's time for us to choose next week's episode. And so here I am at untitledstartrekproject.com/randomizer, and it's my turn to push the button.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask which shows you are including and excluding?
I am including all of them because I'm really tired and can't think of a good reason to exclude any. And because just now we kind of scrolled back through the website and I think we've been doing
everywhere,
a wide range of things. Yeah. So
the only thing is when we put everything into the randomizer, it absolutely favors 90s Trek.
90s Trek, because there's so much.
There's so many bloody episodes.
Yeah. But that's all right. That's all right. We can correct for that if we come up with things. But I think that when we did The Raven last week as a just standard average episode of 90s Trek, there was still a lot of fun to be had. So I am willing to go anywhere, I think.
I have heard this rumor, yes.
All right. Okay. I'm going to press a button.
Go for it.
Oh, okay. I've started with the Lower Decks episode.
Oh, go on.
Yeah, it's The Spy Humongous from Series 2, Series 2, Episode 6.
I haven't seen that one.
And it's a Packland episode.
Oh. Well, I mean, I haven't seen that one. And there's very few, oh, no, I hadn't seen that Discovery episode the other week, have I, either? I'm a terrible fan, me. Well, that was down to you, because I really don't know much about Series 2 of Lower Decks.
I mean, it's good. Lower Decks is always good. It is properly funny, and the Packleds are a great big bad
for Lower Decks. But I feel there's a buck coming anyway.
But I just don't want this process to be over, so I am going to vote again for, literally no reason.
Just because we love pressing the button.
That's it. I get one go at pressing the button. How is that fair?
No, go on.
I'm going to try again.
Well, you did 5 the other week. You remember we were going for all those short treks?
Yeah.
Yeah. Go on.
Okay, this is Star Trek Voyager.
Okay.
Season 6, Episode 6, Riddles.
Oh, my God. That's the episode I was telling you about the other week. Where, you know, I said 7 of 9 and Neelix were talking about eating food, and there was a whole episode of Chewbacca learning how to be a human again.
Oh.
It's really awful, and there's loads of Neelix in it. Push it again.
Okay. Okay, this is also Star Trek Voyager, and it's part one of a two-part story, I think.
Exciting.
So we would have to do both parts.
Well, of course.
That's our rule. It's The Killing Game from season 4.
Wowzers. That's the one in Nazi Germany.
We were talking about
it
the other week. Yeah.
Oh, man, that would be fun to do, because it's terrible in lots of ways, but it's absolutely bloody brilliant in lots of ways as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've done a few two-parters lately, and I'm absolutely up for another one. What do you reckon?
Well, and it's one of those wonderful episodes where we get to see all the regulars in different roles.
Janeway
is the head of this club and the head of the Resistance, and she has cracking rows with Seven in this, and you can absolutely see that crackling tension between them.
Oh, brilliant. All right, let's do that then.
I'm there for it.
Listening to Untitled's Star Trek Project with Joe Ford and Nathan Bottomley. You can find us online at untitledstartrekproject.com, where you can find links to our Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube channel. Our podcast artwork is by Kayla Ciceron, and the theme was composed by Cameron Lamb. This episode was recorded on the 12th of March 2020 and released on the 18th of March. We'll see you next time for Star Trek Voyager, The Killing Game.